Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Transatlanticist podcast at the America Centrum in Hamburg. I'm your host, Andrew Sola. Joining me today to talk about a number of issues related to the coronavirus and the vaccination rollout, and also some of the economic consequences of the coronavirus for Europe, is our EU expert, Dr. Günther Donner. Welcome, Günther.
Hello.
Okay, so for our talking points today, we have a number of issues to discuss. First, the difficulties in Europe with the vaccination. Secondly, we want to address some of the economic consequences, and specifically if it's better economically to have a shutdown of the economy or not. Third, we want to look at the coronavirus and the future of the EU's welfare state system. And we'll end with a short preview of the German elections in September. So I just want to kick it off with some statistics about the vaccination progress. This is from today. We're recording on the 6th of April. And what we see here for European-wide, so including Britain, the percentage of people in each country who have received at least one vaccine dose is led by Britain, which obviously is no longer in the EU, but at 46.5%. Within the EU, number one is Malta with 35.4%. In last place, we have Bulgaria at a mere 5.87%, but you'll be shocked to hear maybe that the Netherlands is third from bottom at 9.8%, Sweden at 11.5%, and Germany at only 11.98% as of April 2nd, so that probably went up a little bit. EU-wide, however, it's only 12.79%. So, Günther, what do these vaccine numbers tell us when the EU average is 12.79%, but Britain is at 46.52%?
Well, first and foremost, I should say that it reveals a big difference in strategic approach. So it should be probably kept apart a bit from the overall management of the individual government in question, of the whole crisis in relation with the COVID pandemic. We know very well from, I mean, the facts show it, that the United Kingdom was really in dire straits with COVID, with reference to strains put on the NHS, with numbers of severely ill people requiring inpatient treatment at intensive care units, and as well, one has to say, with the death ratio. All that was very high. So at a certain moment of time, the government turned round. There have been many turnarounds by the Johnson government, and concentrated on partly lockdown and vaccination at all costs. So they launched an aggressive campaign to increase the number of at least one-time vaccinated people. Whereas in Europe, there was no coherent strategy discernible. I couldn't tell you of any. EU summits on these issues normally resulted in rather helplessly glossed over friction. So they never reached much common ground.
Günther, we've talked a lot about the systemic challenges of the EU, that is, getting all of these different countries to agree on anything.
Mm-hmm.
And so should we really be surprised by what you called the helplessness of the EU together in dealing with this crisis?
What surprises me and surprised me when it started was the fact that knowing about all too well about the inherent weaknesses of the EU as a system, especially a system expected to perform rather abrupt decision making that is completely alien to them. They have no idea how to put that into practice. The normal decision making process in Europe takes years. And so they were, on the one hand, they were at a loss. On the other, they felt compelled to arrive at a common, whatever they call it, a common solution or strategy, so as not to abandon the momentum and the idea of the European super state, in inverted commas, in a moment of that magnitude. I think that they had very little chance to get away with a positive effect on analysts. Whatever they might have done would have led to criticism. So I
might suggest the Joe Biden trick, which was to have low expectations and then exceed them. And when I look at Biden's campaign, people really aren't even questioning him that much about his handling of the vaccine rollout, because he underpromised and overdelivered. He said 100 million vaccine doses in the first 100 days, knowing quite well that he would totally smash those numbers. And it seems like one of the issues for me that Ursula von der Leyen had is she couldn't quite set a narrative of success.
Well, there are a few, to my reading, there are a few quite remarkable differences. When the catastrophic disease management of the Trump administration ended with the last day of this gentleman in office, and Biden took over, he and his team were well prepared, and they had a very simple strategy from the onset. They would listen to scientific expertise, what Trump never did. He had scientists to pay lip service to his crude ideas and convictions. But the Biden administration took a very clever path. They listened to expertise. The expertise was there. The expertise was deeply related with the provisions done during the Trump years. I mean, the idea, the warp speed management as in itself was remarkable, something you could never see in Europe. What was done with it, the idea how the crisis was interpreted during the Trump administration was a disaster. That was clearly a different story, but the American effectiveness and efficiency was always shining through. So when Biden took over, he decided to listen to the experts, to concentrate on this issue, leaving other issues at present discussed in America to satiety, leaving those aside, and he concentrated on the issue we have to come to grips with, this historic challenge of the pandemic. He concentrated on it, and he made use of his enormous power. There is no political figure apart from the president of France who has.
He did all these things, and he managed expectations so he could exceed them. And what I haven't heard, either from von der Leyen, and that's why she's being so criticized, but also from national leaders throughout the EU, is some way of defining success and how they've dealt with this, or how they're going to deal with this.
Frau von der Leyen just lacks the power to do so. If she were to define success in terms of per capita percentage quotas of vaccinated people within a given period of time, she would illegally interfere with the sovereign member state's right to set and define its own priorities in healthcare and disease protection. She could only give advice. She couldn't even have ordered vaccines on her own. For that, she needed a confirmation and an order, so to speak, by the member states. We do it jointly via the Commission. The Commission, power-wise, cannot be compared to the US president. This is one difference. The other is that from the onset, Brussels had to reset its strategic approach to healthcare crises. That is normally endless debates. For years have we been discussing medicinal products, a directive. I think it took about 9 years till it was finally passed. A quick decision with severe and noticeable effects. Anybody, any European from the Danube Delta up to the Polar Circle would in the end take notice, is not their cup of tea, to put it in a British fashion. So what they did was, it was a compromise. It was a compromise of A, doing nothing, that was out of the question, and doing anything comparable to what Biden and his administration have until now carried out to perfection in America. That was completely out of their legal scope of power. And right. You see,
and Biden, for, and we have talked about this before in private, but one of the powers that Biden has that von der Leyen, for example, does not have, and I don't even think Merkel has it as the Chancellor of Germany, is a so-called Defense Production Act, where you can essentially strong-arm companies to produce what you want them to produce because of a national emergency. So you can really, you know, start twisting arms as the U.S. president in ways that von der Leyen cannot do, and also presumably that someone like Chancellor Merkel can't do.
So let me just add, I mean, you are the American, I'm the European. Let me just ask, it's with growing desperation, especially for the future acceptance of the EU model, to which I still see no alternative in Europe. And with this growing preoccupation I personally have, given this rather lame performance, a thing like the Defense Production Act needs explanation for Europeans, because no state in Europe could ever dream of having such a thing. You introduced it in 1950 during the Korean War. And the idea of directing industrial production for a single, rather sharply defined government purpose is absolutely alien to EU policy making of exchange, trade, and to give and to receive. That is exactly what one of the causes. You don't export any vaccines now, and rightfully so, you don't do it. Even the Canadians, now they may get something, used to buy their vaccines on the EU market and got it from Belgium. You used it for American purposes. That was very successful. Now, for the Europeans, and there has been a very vigorous discussion among member states, shouldn't they ban exports of vaccines produced, say, of Pfizer vaccines produced in Belgium? Why don't they forbid exportation of such stuff? That's too easy. Apart from what you do in America, where you have the whole product made on your own territory, the EU pharmaceutical industry is a multinational business. So upstream products would come from China, from Taiwan, from wherever, from Korea. And until the product is complete, that means ready for use, you need the vaccine, you need the cannulas, you need the little bottles, you need the syringes, you need whatever. All this is a give and take. And all this is based on international trade. We are in no way able to replace this from one day to the other with EU-made products. A year or so ago, we had a dramatic deficit for protective equipment mm-hmm. imported from China. I mean, even a blocked Suez Canal might put paid for weeks, and you wait weeks longer for your deliveries. And that would cripple the production, the chain of how to produce this until ready for use on the consumer. So this is not, I'm not saying this in order to defend the EU weaknesses, which are clear, evident, and inherent. it's a relative approach. So the idea of dramatically posing as a politician and saying, well, then we ban all exports and the problem is solved. This is nonsense. This is an empty promise. It might help for a week or two, and then it might even get worse. So you have to continue a very rather slow, but still uphill march. I mean, why is it the different quotas of vaccination? Clearly, it stands to reason that a country as small and as regionally limited as Malta just needs a few doses and you can vaccinate the population. They would, of course, gladly accept it. You have no campaign, you have no opposition parties being against it. The general discussion on the island of Malta, whether or not to open the economy or to close it, is probably less serious than we have it in Germany or we have it in France. Let me add one last remark. I mean, what Biden and his administration have hitherto shown as a success is impressive. But don't forget, even he and his next to almighty administration is absolutely helpless when you start having your football events with 30,000 spectators again, less than 10% wearing masks. Because one governor, still challenging the idea of the Trump administration, thinks this fit to do.
And this is indeed one similarity between the U.S. federalized system and the German system, of course. Although someone like Governor DeSantis of Florida is much more rebellious against Biden than, for example, is it Herr Laschet or Herr Söder in Bavaria are against Frau Merkel.
None of these people, not even, especially not those now changing the voting rights at a regional level, could ever run for political office in Germany or France.
Okay, and I actually want to stop you there because, you know, we've spent 4 years with various critiques of the way the U.S. does things. So it's a little bit of payback now.
Yes.
I do want to talk
rightfully
about...
Rightfully so, I have to admit.
I want to talk about the fact that it seems that no one in Europe, no politician in Europe, will pay a political price for their mishandling of, for example, the vaccination rollout. Everyone can blame, for example, the EU Commission, and apparently von der Leyen is willing to take some arrows for the team. But it's not like you're going to get resignations of senior ministers for this problem. It seems like there are no political consequences as of yet.
Well, there is a simple explanation for this. We have, many European countries have coalition governments, but in this case, and with talking about the COVID pandemic, the common denominator of consensus is much, much vaster, much larger than the governing coalition. So if you take the German example, you have a coalition of a conservative and a social democrat socialist party. Yeah, you have a green opposition, you have an extreme right opposition and a liberal opposition, which is very small. What you see is just with the exception of the extreme right merits a closer look during the whole pandemic because it's altered course and condition very significantly. It's been radicalized, it's been irrationalized.
Even more so than it was?
Much more so. Much more so. And I mean, they started with criticizing the Euro system. And now they are together with people, at least some, but those are gaining influence. They are together with people who call into question the legitimacy of the German state. Mm-hmm. Which is absurd, historically speaking. But they are there not to give solutions, and that makes it so easy for them. The extreme right gives no solutions. The extreme right will deliver culprits, scapegoats, and propaganda based on fake news or whatever.
Well, it's easier to criticize than offer solutions.
It is, and their strategy is to avoid offering solutions. What they wish is they wish to benefit from as much public discontent as possible, because that serves them well and saves them from the rather dangerous moment where they would have to put strategies down on the table for scrutiny. Then they would be finished. There is no. It doesn't make any sense.
Right. I think that's clear. But I do want to go back to the point that no politician will have to fall on his or her sword for this, including someone like the health minister of Germany, Herr Spahn. But I don't think, you know, again, from my American perspective, if I were still in the United States, I would have been vaccinated months ago.
Yes.
Sadly, I'm not.
No, no doubt.
And I will be waiting many more months. And at least, again, going back to the idea of politicians creating a narrative of success, no one seems to have done that. There's no sense of optimism or hope that we're going to get out of this in Europe. Indeed, everyone's going back into curfews and extreme lockdowns. And actually, there's no sense that this pandemic is being conquered. And yet the political class, and indeed health ministers, whomever you would choose to blame, seem to sail over it, either blaming other people or just saying, oh, well, we all have to be patient.
As far as Germany is concerned, I mean, there is a certain difference that stems from the constitutional construction of power and competence.
I want to see heads roll, Gunther.
You want to see heads roll, you won't. You might see people slowly but surely understanding that their career might be doomed. That far I might go. I think seeing heads roll is not the proper answer for this pandemic.
I mean figuratively.
Yes, I know. But what we have to see is lessons learned. And that is far more, because this won't be the last pandemic, maybe the last of my or your lifetime, but it, clearly not the last for mankind. And a final judgment of how the political arm of society has managed this enormous challenge should reasonably be given at a later date. We now know that what went wrong. Again, I'm not a great admirer of the present acting federal health minister, but I know very well about the limitations of his power. It is not within his power, as it is not within the power of Joe Biden, to stop Georgia from passing a law that would have fit in the Germany of the 30s, or to stop governors from opening businesses as if the pandemic had been broken. He can't.
Well, someone has to be responsible for the vaccination botch-up job, and I do want to hit on the AstraZeneca point again.
Yes.
So how do we get to this situation where the EU puts most of its eggs in the AstraZeneca basket, and that seems to be either a weak basket or some weak eggs? I don't know how that metaphor continues, but
it's probably...
And I actually am teaching a course focusing on the ethics of pandemics at my technical university right now. And I was really annoyed a couple of weeks ago when there was the discovery of some blood clots,
mm-hmm.
a small handful out of millions and millions mm-hmm. and millions of vaccines given. And all of these various European countries chose to delay giving the AstraZeneca mm-hmm. vaccine until they figured this out. But we knew that the vaccine had been studied at great depth, and it had been given to tens and tens of millions of people, and there were maybe a handful of people who had bad side effects, which is tragic and horrible and wrong. But my point to my students was this. Imagine if you were in a tall building that's on fire, and the fire is slowly moving up the building. And the fire department comes, the state-run fire department with their state-run gear, and they call up to you and say, we'd love to save you from this burning building, but we have a 1 in 100 chance that our ladders will break. So until we figure out this technical problem, we just hope we put out the fire because these ladders are not approved for use and you might actually fall off as we're trying to rescue you. It's like at a certain point, you have to say, I'm going to take the risk and climb down this ladder. Thank you, state. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to force people to do it. People can be given information. A doctor can explain, you know, you might get a blood clot. 1 out of 10 million people do. But to say no one can get it as the building is burning seems to be, to my mind, an extremely wrong response. More people are dying every day because of these delays.
Well, you're partly correct. And if you look at the UK, I think, reported roughly about between 30 and 40 cases. And millions of Brits have been vaccinated with exactly AstraZeneca. But so they are clearly did it in a different fashion. But what was so remarkable here, and I think that's a conglomerate of responsibility. A, AstraZeneca had a difficult start. It came with a phase 3 study where quota of elderly patients was insufficient. For that, they were, by bureaucracies in Europe, considered, well, this should be handled with caution because there are no data there. Don't forget, under normal circumstances, this would have taken years for a vaccine to be scrutinized until it's declared ready for use. So this was by comparison, lightning speed. That said, this enhanced public doubts, probably public fears and governmental uneasiness about what might happen if. The thing was, we need a vaccine. Is it a good one? We will find out. That is one point. The other is, when the crisis started and the first countries to stop using this product were Denmark, among others, Denmark, Norway and Austria. And that started a discussion at all levels, from German authorities to the EMA authorities responsible for the EU.
But EMA is the European Medical Agency.
Yes, indeed. And so they then declared, after a scrutiny of about 2.5 days, well, what is that in terms of data analysis, they declared it fit for use. No, one or whatever, a minority vote that I've read today, is moving away from this and seeing or admitting that there might be a connection between blood clots and the use of this vaccine. So this to and fro, this in and out, has greatly damaged the image of this therapeutical product.
But no one could besmirch the impeccable nature of the bureaucratic process, and that's the most important thing.
I think you are exactly right. We are, and that refers to Germany. Germany clearly is overstaffed with bureaucrats. And simple decision.
Shall we just take a moment to pause so I can just discuss my trials and travails with getting my German driver's license? No, that's a joke. I've already talked about this.
bureaucracy here has replaced political decision making, and so we would like to base all decision making on the basis of an untenable magnitude of safety features. Nobody has courage to make a decision, left or right, A or B. That is part of our new zeitgeist culture, I should say. A and B is black and white. We can't do
this. Are you saying there was an age when European bureaucrats were more flexible?
No, far more decision oriented. Go back in German history, and that's certainly not the nicest periods of German history, when this would have been done with a compulsory vaccination program and carried out within a month, probably. Even the German Democratic Republic had compulsory vaccination programs for whatever disease, and they never left the country. Back in German history, the state was highly influential and easily capable of telling people you are vaccinated tomorrow or you go to jail. So all this was abandoned, and I have to say there are democratic favours. There are a democratic light shining through. Germany was an authoritarian state in her past.
Mm-hmm.
Now we aren't that anymore. And the same.
I don't think you're creating an unfair distinction between authoritarianism and over bureaucracy. There can be some sort of non-authoritarian state that doesn't have paralyzed bureaucracy preventing people from.
I may not have been clear enough. I think it's my fault. An out of bounds, extremely wide ranging bureaucracy is a field that gives justifications to politically charged and empowered people not to do anything
and to push it
away.
I just have to add a verbal footnote here to the state bureaucracies that fund the Transatlanticist podcast. We're not talking about you.
Well, I think there would be no understanding of criticism. Bureaucracy is never... It can never be linked to an individual. It's a process. It's a process of unclear responsibility, of unclear pathways towards arriving at a certain goal. If all this has to be verified, you can make rules so complicated that you will never move out. I mean, if you go from A to B, you have to leave your home, you have to walk, and you finally will arrive somewhere. But if you double check, triple check, and quadruple check it all beforehand, in the end, you might remain at home. And you say, well, it's all still undergoing scrutiny. And you can have that for years. Bureaucracy carried to the extreme replaces quick decision making, which one has to add, for a politician, may be dangerous. People like endless discussions. We've had many, many years ago, many years of a permanent discussion of how to reform our orthography, which is very complicated. You're not a native speaker of German, but you will know. I mean, writing German with capital and small letters is very difficult. So that was about to be reformed. In the end, it became more complicated after years of discussion. And very few Germans understood what it was all about. But that is a typical thing where...
Is this... France also has some sort of committees that protect their written and spoken language.
The French bureaucracy is of a different nature because, of course, there is a different history. History of a centralized state like France, right, were ruled out in Germany for good reason, mm-hmm, after two historic catastrophes.
Yeah, and that's the other thing we always forget. It's almost impossible to talk about any country within the EU in properly comparative ways because their histories are so radically different. So, but anyway, I'd love to carry on with a lengthy rant on different types of annoying bureaucrats and how they are similar and different. But I just want to sum up this section by just thinking about a question that I had written down, which is this, and we covered some of these, but I just want to kind of summarize or conclude each of these. The question was this: what are the political, industrial, bureaucratic, and social hurdles preventing the vaccine rollout from succeeding? The political hurdles we've discussed, namely, we have a number of different EU countries. It's hard to get them all on board going in the same direction. The system isn't designed politically for rapid decision making. The same goes with the bureaucratic issues. It's just a very large battleship to move. Or we might say it is difficult to navigate the cargo ship in the Suez Canal.
Mm-hmm.
What was it called? The Ever Given?
The Ever Given, yeah.
The Ever Given. Industrial hurdles? Are there any industrial hurdles to this?
Oh, yes.
Well, you just discussed the fact that, obviously, with a global supply chain, it's hard to get everything you need to produce the vaccine, as it were, all within the EU. And we haven't discussed this final point, and I'll let you just close this section on this. What are the social obstacles? And here I'm just talking about people refusing to get the vaccine, even if it were available.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is a clear repercussion, and EU societies again would react totally different. I've just been talking the other day with Hungary, where people are lining up for vaccinations. They would do that here in Germany, but certain numbers would not. They would refuse it because the movement, and that is very close to the irrational movement of the big lie or whatever you call it in America, these people wishing to occupy the seat of parliament. This is a movement that is anti-big government. And that is a new idea. It was there. It used to be there years ago, but very, very in a very modest form you wouldn't really take note of. But that has grown. So last Saturday we had many thousands of people denying COVID, belittling its effects on society, calling to question scientific data without any foundation or without any evidence. But that is now a new firm belief. And it's an ideology. And parts of these groups are very similar to what you have in America. To name a few, it's QAnon. That's spreading out here, but not to the degree you know it in America. But others call into question this in order to destabilize the form of government and the form of state we have here. So with all its shortcomings and with all its insufficiencies as to how to run the show in this unexpected and unprepared for moment of crisis, I'm still quite happy and quite hopeful that we will get over this in the long run without too much damage to our democratic structures. I am opposed to an omnipotent commandeering state telling people what to do now and when and how with both vaccinations and saving the environment and whatever. But I'm also against a destabilization of democratic practices and hurdles. Having a reduced power of central government in Germany, I still consider in the limelight of history as an achievement rather than a failure.
And I would agree with all of that, except when it comes to public health and a public health emergency, sometimes you got to have more power. And there, they do have more power. These lockdowns in Germany are, one could argue, drastic overreach of the government, preventing us from our freedom of movement, for example.
Well, they are absolutely...
And actually, you know what? So we've been hammering all of these COVID points, but our second major subject for today was kind of about freedom of movement, but now we're talking about freedom to go into a shop or a restaurant, into a bar. So subject two for today was lockdowns versus no lockdowns. And I think as an economist, you're the best person to talk about what the facts are. Is it better or worse for the economy as a whole to shut down the economy during the pandemic? Or should we go on the Florida or Swedish model, which is everyone should just do whatever they want? So what do you think about
the
economic issue?
It's very clear. I mean, it's abysmal nonsense.
What is abysmal nonsense?
It's abysmal nonsense to open a few shops for a couple of days in order to close them down for good at a high price of spreading infections out of control. The idea of you on one hand have virologist expertise versus economic analysis, to me, it doesn't make any sense. The problem we have is the infection. The problem is the consequence the infection has for our society in terms of strain on the healthcare system. That is number one. Because with a collapse of the healthcare system, you wouldn't see any economic recovery for a very, very long period of time. So what we now need is a clear and well-regulated reduction of infections, and at the same time, this should be flanked by an increase of vaccinations. What you do the other way around in America, what you can do is you increase your vaccinations. The lockdown you can't really do, because that in your country is, as it is in ours, a matter of local government. So what you will see is a conflict between these two, and have Professor Fust, one of the leading German economists, just recently pointed out how important it is now not to modify. We have a little lockdown here and a little bigger one there, and a fourth type of lockdown we do there, and nobody knows after this what is carried out, what is valid where. And that is disastrous. It will have no acceptance, that will create a chaos and to more infections. And so what we need is we have to reduce infections at all costs. That is number one. And we increase the vaccinations, because we now have at least some hope that a vaccinated person will pose no danger for his or her environment anymore.
And that also means then having the shops and places closed down.
You have to, because that is terrible news for the individual shop owner. I fully understand this. And it is almost unbearable to listen to people who do not accept the individual catastrophe that is unfolding due to this. But if we were not to do it, and you will see this in Florida or wherever, you know, your states open up as if corona had never existed, you will see infection rates mounting and sky high. Vaccinations or not, that is about to happen, and that will put stress again, and that in the end might come up as whatever X plus one wave of infection. So I think the lockdown, as understood to be the sole instrument to see a result or to reduce interhuman contact, to put it mildly, is without any alternative.
Having spent some time in the U.S., in Florida, which I would call experiencing absolute civil freedom there, it is very frustrating being back in Germany, where despite all of the lockdown measures, it hasn't done anything really to change the curve, as it were. When I left for the States, we were in lockdown, and we came back, and we're still in lockdown. And you do wonder, being in Florida, where there is none of this back and forth, you know, what's the point?
Well,
if everything were open still or not, it seems like all we can say about the lockdown in Germany, yes, is it didn't make things worse. But I wonder if it would have been so much worse without the lockdown. If you get the word out to people that things are still dangerous, they will behave in different ways, I believe. And then the companies don't have to die. But this is a philosophical point.
I don't believe in the overall and general readiness for people to act reasonably.
Nor do I, but I believe in my own ability.
Yes, you can. But you wouldn't go into a stadium in Florida now.
Of course not.
But
if some idiots do and want to, that's fine for them.
Yeah, it's fine for them. But
there are people who will not also respond to a lockdown well. I think that's the key point. The assumption that, oh, we institute the lockdown here in Germany and suddenly dumb people will not get infected, I think that's the point that is wrong. They will find a way to get infected no matter what, because they just will do whatever unsafe behaviors out of public view, like all these kids having parties together.
You see this in Europe, and you have a big trial run that is Madrid. Madrid is almost open because the regional government could also run in certain of your states. They actively juxtapose the central government's rulings on corona by doing exactly the contrary. Within their constitutional powers, of course, yeah. So it's you cannot do anything. You can't do anything against it. what you see there is now that young French people come over because France is closed. So they now go to Madrid, where you can see people sitting there in the old town.
Madrid is the West Palm Beach or the Miami of...
It probably is, but there are a few more people there and a healthcare system already in dire straits. Mm-hmm. When you experience lockdown here in Germany, you don't even know, because there is no definition for lockdown. The lockdown some 5 miles from here is different from the lockdown where we sit. This is the problem. The problem is that people are fed up with this now is allowed, this is forbidden, this is allowed, this is forbidden. Now it's allowed again, then it's forbidden again. And that doesn't make any sense. Now we have one local prime minister of the biggest state who invented over the Easter days a new term for lockdown. It's a bridge lockdown. I don't know, it's a bridge to until nowhere, probably.
He's trying to create some sort of positive narrative.
Indeed.
Following the rule book of the politicians, which is to make bad things sound less bad.
Indeed.
By calling
and
them
that
something else.
Probably explains the chaotic situation and the lack of definitions in this. Had we had a strict lockdown with schools, kindergartens, and whatever, and an obligation for people, anybody who can, to work from home, infection digits might be better now. Until we have a general or a broader stream of vaccinations pouring in. But this was impossible because local politicians wished to set themselves apart from what the central government suggested. They have to do it a bit their own way. And I think above all, it shouldn't be equal to what their neighbor state does. And that shows how frail our political system is to these tremendous challenges. We've never had such a challenge before. So I don't take offense and politicians not knowing how to react. I would like to see more of a well-defined, logic-based nature. And all virologists and medical experts I've read are still of the opinion that a harsh lockdown in order to reduce transmissions is okay. And the idea that this is crippling the economy is right. But if you don't do it, there will be nothing left to cripple.
Well, I think the politicians here need to take a page from the old DDR, the old East German politicians, and they should call this new bridge lockdown something much happier, like the...
Freedom lockdown is good.
Well, no, I was thinking more of like the pro-good health, the pro-good health isolation initiative.
Yeah, but, I mean, we are joking about it, but... I would like to stress also a rather debatable role of the media. The media are focusing on any such words as ridiculous as they may be and as out of all meaning and content, devoid of all contents. But they put them, you can read them at almost any German paper
these Gunther, days. But Gunther, the only way we have to talk about things is with the words we use to talk about them.
Yeah.
And that's why... Yeah, I mean, sure, the media is probably not being nice, but also, you know, if you call, like in the U.S., the Patriot Act, people tend to think it's good because it's called the Patriot Act. So you got to do this. Anyway, okay, enough COVID. I'm sure everyone on the planet has heard enough of our opinions about the coronavirus. So let's talk about a post-coronavirus world.
Mm-hmm.
And this is actually a extremely important point that politicians do need to get right, because there are massive, massive ramifications in every level of society due to the coronavirus. The labor market's changing, small businesses are changing, the cultural sector, the hospitality sector, tourism. There are some major, major, major changes that we're going through now. The world is going to look and is looking a lot different already. So Gunther, you wanted to focus here on the welfare state. So how are all these economic changes going to affect all of the very generous social services that those of us who live in Europe enjoy?
I think it will affect it in many ways, the totality of which are still difficult to describe. So just a few sketches. The welfare state including some welfare states concepts that mostly exist on paper in Europe, so in reality are less tangible as they may be here, is a concept to make democracy more stable. To me, a well-functioning welfare state is absolutely indispensable for a democratic system, unless you would like to see different parallel worlds within a given state. Levels of poverty you would normally find elsewhere. So there is a highly individual scope of such systems. All EU's member states have such a thing, though with great differences in financial capacity, generosity, absence of corruption or whatever. That was pre-Corona. Now, many of the EU member states already then were heavily indebted. That has worsened to the extreme. The total debt load that Corona will leave behind still cannot be fathomed.
We talked about certain problem economies pre-pandemic. Italy was always one of your big concerns.
Spain, Portugal, Greece.
So, but a country like Italy that, for example, is well known actually for having quite an excellent healthcare system.
Yeah, probably more, yeah.
Didn't do so well in the first part of the pandemic.
Well, the Italian...
Things are getting worse now. I mean, but post-pandemic, can they retain their... And it's not only a reputation thing. They have to deliver the goods, you know.
Well...
Are they going to be able to, for example, invest enough so that if you are an Italian living wherever in Italy, can you expect in 5 years the same quality of healthcare you had 5 years previously?
Much depends. They could not just out of their own pocket. I mean, let's face it, the debt load of the Italian public and private system, including those of the Italian financial system, is so heavy and used to be so heavy before COVID-19 came, that they were depending on artificial access to a capital market, which was the euro mechanism. And that has worsened to an enormous degree. Now the country sees enormous and ever-widening cleavages between certain regions. The healthcare and welfare system is a regionalized one. So what would still be acceptable to a German standard in northern Italy, what you find with the same general legislation in a southern Italian environment is totally different. And that will worsen. So without an additional enormous debt load, you can not take, you won't be, they won't be able to take it up on the financial market to market conditions. But they could probably survive by the many diverse mechanisms the EU has introduced to enable them to take out debts at preferential conditions. The point is, for the younger generation, employment might stop. It's already a disaster in Italy.
We talked about the youth employment problem several years ago.
That will worsen, and so many qualified people might leave the country to try to work elsewhere. The idea is they're not out of the woods. They are moving deeper into the woods, probably. The same is true for Spain. Okay, the Spanish economy is largely depending on tourism. Once Corona is defeated, that is, no longer poses a threat, justifying limitations of travel and movement, the Spanish tourist industry might recover. The thing is, and that goes to show how bulletproof or crisis-proof an individual enterprise is, do you have a capital reserve? Will your banks tolerate you not paying the installments regularly for a couple of months? Or do they force you to liquidate? That is the individual questions many will have to face. A good example is the once almighty French hotel trust Accor, that was facing enormous financial difficulties and received hundreds of millions of direct state loans
from France,
from the French government. So that might help to survive. But the first hurdle is to overcome the immediate financial consequences. The second will be, will Corona in the long run influence travel patterns of customers? Will people travel less? Maybe they've out of money, they have less time, or they've got used to staying at home. Germans used to be very active travelers, mostly to sunny Mediterranean countries, above all Spain. Italy being too expensive, so they go to Spain. Will this continue? Will this reappear on the scene, or will we see less? Maybe. Air transportation will become much more expensive. Airlines are, in spite of government subsidies, will we continue to fly for a song and a dance to a southern country on holiday to fill the hotels and holiday apartments with whatever infrastructure there is? Or will this be reduced to a level where flying perhaps is much more expensive and people think twice before they go and take out a third holiday? We can't tell now, but this is one danger for tourism. If it's high-class tourism, that will come back.
Right.
Because the crisis has, and that is, one has to state it openly, people with a fortune have become richer.
Right.
And much richer. So Venice tourism for those with sufficient funding, they will reappear on the scene. That's never been a cheap tourism resort, cheap in inverted commas, but for mass tourism. Yet our tourism in world is has a very short time.
This is I'm sorry to ask you if you have a stat in the forefront of your brain. What overall percentage is tourism and hospitality of the EU's GDP, would you say?
If you can
ballpark it. But so in a country like Cyprus, it must be like
70%. Spain is probably almost close to 50. And the thing is, it might...
So essentially, the...
With a huge difference.
Types of productivity we see in Northern Europe, one can call it a subsidy for the tourism industry
in
the southern.
It has regional value. If you go to North German states, you will see they are the great winners of people no longer traveling abroad for whatever reasons. Be this, I would like to reduce environmental pollution by flying to wherever, so I stay at home. And warm summers in Germany have of course contributed to this choice. So there it is, but it's a regional category. Whereas in countries like Spain, you named Cyprus and Portugal as well, especially certain areas in the south, tourism used to be the big employment creating machine. It's particularly employment, because an investment in a new factory completely equipped with modern technology might not give you that much employment at a local basis for people with a limited training. And that's the great problem of these Mediterranean countries, that tourism used to give, at a regular basis, enormous amounts of seasonal but rather predictable income sources, employment, to people not qualified to work elsewhere, probably. Will this come back? I think much of it depends on, will the German industry be characterized, or will they decide to go into massive layoffs after the crisis? People having less income, they will travel less. Will this continue to at a rather high level? If you look at the German DAX, German industry is rather positive. It's the highest point ever in its history now. Will Germany be able to export her complicated and expensive technological machinery and equipment the world over? And these people producing them will receive a good income. They will go on holiday, and then why shouldn't they go to Spain? So we are all depending on each other. If income, the income situation for the broader members of the public will go down in Germany. Those who used to travel. It's not the extremely poor, they never travel. No, but it's the lower and middle class and upper middle class people. If their income situation in the long run will worsen, they will travel less.
Okay, so I think you put it really well, and you explained how interrelated and how different each European country's economy is, but how they are all blended together in such good ways. One might say that the German worker for Lufthansa Technik or Siemens subsidizes the seasonal work of a lovely little village in Spain.
Of course. If you look at Majorca.
So, last question on this topic, Gunther, really quickly. Vaccine passports, good idea, bad idea?
I think if you connect the state of being fully vaccinated with individual privileges of having a larger amount of freedom of movement, you need a passport because you have to make it foolproof to prove this, and this passport has to be, to my reading, in the rather uniform nature, because if you have hundreds of versions of this, it won't be of any value. I think it's a stimulus, and that is the criticism. The criticism is that's a compulsory vaccination through the back door. I'm not sure whether opening new liberties to a privileged minority, hopefully one's majority, by allowing them to do more because they've been vaccinated, completely vaccinated, is all that easy with the German constitution. I'm not sure, but it certainly requires one thing: infallible evidence that being vaccinated reduces your capacity or limits or puts an end to your capacity to infect others. If this is unclear or in debate, where's the legitimate? It could not be legitimate.
I love your nuanced answer, Gunther. Vaccine passports, though, good idea or bad idea?
Good idea.
Good, me too. I have, just from my background as a social contract thinker, I think that in order to participate in a community, you have to give up certain freedoms, which we do, such as, for example, paying taxes. We all have to pay taxes to participate in our system. And maybe if you want to be able to travel to Mallorca or Spain or Cyprus or wherever, got to show that you're vaccinated too. But we'll be done with that now because we just have 3 minutes, Gunther. We will do a long episode on the German elections, never you fear. But we just wanted to end now with a short preview of what the recent regional elections in Baden-Württemberg and
Palatinate
and Rheinland-Pfalz, or no, just Rheinland-Pfalz, just Rheinland-Pfalz, yeah, and Baden-Württemberg, what they tell us about what we can expect in the big elections coming up in September. September.
Well, to make a long story short, in both states, nothing has changed much. What was picked out by the media was the bad performance of the conservative CDU party in both states, in the past exclusively run by the CDU. It shows two things. A, and Rheinland-Pfalz, the incumbent candidate, Mrs. Dreyer, was well respected and is contrary to the performance of her Social Democratic Party, which is negligible throughout Germany, is still could stage a victory. That is the candidate and not the party. And you see the Greens leading the sole state they rule and they govern. Baden-Württemberg, once a traditionally conservative area, a very affluent, very conservative, quite Catholic. The Greens there with their unbelievably qualified candidate, Kretschmer, an elderly gentleman doing a great job, I have to say. I'm not a Green Party enthusiast by no means, but he does a great job. He's not an ideologist. He's a trustworthy policy broker, knowing his limits. And he has just cut out all the media debate on the new traffic light coalition by not, well, I think he wishes, contrary to many in his party, to continue his collaboration, his coalition government with the CDU party for many reasons. One is in Baden-Württemberg, where most of our top industrial products sold the world over are made, you cannot tell people that having a car is a bad idea and you should do whatever instead. You have to find
He's a pragmatist.
He's a pragmatist and a very shrewd politician. And the CDU has performed badly because they had a very weak candidate. It shows you need a strong candidate. Without a strong candidate, you're down because a party doesn't attract anybody anymore. And it shows that premature speculation on changing governments may not be that realistic. I mean, prognosis is that with the continuation of a green conservative coalition government in Baden-Württemberg, this might have helped the CDU in the federal election in September, provided they come up with a suitable candidate.
I agree with your assessment, but I'm frightful if the German people or if the German political situation in general goes down the track of having a personality as a leader.
It's been the case for decades. Please don't forget, Willy Brandt was the symbol of peace and not conservatism. Yeah. Helmut Kohl was the symbol of the reunification from
Merkel. But did they run that way? Or did that personality cult, as it were, arise after their election?
To me, when I was very young then, to me, Willy Brandt, not my party, was a person of character because of his absolutely crystal clear and snow-white non-Nazi past. That was still a question in Germany in the 70s and then the late 60s. So then came Mr. Kohl. Herr Kohl was a provincial politician who was not my personal favorite candidate. But when the historic window of opportunity opened for the reunification of Germany with the help of your then president, the elder Bush, he made use of it. And he did it.
But that's what I'm saying. I mean, their reputations as chancellor were built as they were chancelloring, rather than what we often see in the United States, where you have sort of a already pre-prepared public persona that is being elected.
No, Kohl was once prime minister of Rheinland-Pfalz, and before he became a federal politician, and he was there. He was, for many, he was too conservative or too provincial, too much of Catholic probably for North Germany. That then still was a bigger question than it's today. But he was clearly not a very august politician. He wasn't flamboyant. He was a tactician. And Frau Merkel was an enormous strategic thinker. Or still is.
Reputation. But what was her reputation when she was elected?
She's from East Germany. And when she first entered cabinet as a lower ranking cabinet minister, she was considered the little girl by many, completely underrated. And now she's one of the most prominent and respected politicians the world over. And she's never been an ideologist. Never. That, to me, has much merit. Ideologies are very dangerous. And there is not, and that, to me, still is a favor, because we see so many scandals in politics, so many individual misdemeanors. And that is destabilizing for democracy. During all her 16 years in office, there wasn't a shadow of a doubt on Merkel's personal integrity. Contrary to Kohl, Kohl ended in disaster, as we all know. A very, very strange thing.
But Merkel did not. And I think we will have to do a show before the elections, and we'll do one afterwards. And when we have a new chancellor to discuss, we can always, and will in fact, have a first go at assessing Merkel's 16-year chancellorship.
Yeah.
But that requires its own, I think, its own proper section. But we do have to end it there. Thank you, Günter Donner. That was a really interesting discussion.
You're most welcome.
And thank you to everyone who's listened. And we will actually go out here with Günter playing us the Transatlanticist theme on piano. So in addition to Günter's wonderful knowledge about the EU, he's a great pianist. So thanks for that, Günter. We'll see you next time.
And see you. Thanks for having me.
Just so you know, once again, the views and opinions expressed on the show are those of the guests or the host, not the Americazentrum, which does not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Thanks again for listening.